and ready, because after I'm done describing it, you know, I'll give you the address and all the stuff if you want to help out. That's really cool. Books to Prisoners is a non-profit organization run entirely by volunteers, whose purpose is to fulfill the reading needs of incarcerated individuals. We do this by responding to book requests mailed directly to our organization by prisoners across the United States. The service is free of charge. Since its inception in 1979, the project has seen a steady increase in requests. Currently, we have to wade through 600 to 800 requests a month. As the project only opens on two evenings a week, prisoners sometimes have to wait up to 4 months to receive their package of books. We offer a wide variety of subjects from which prisoners may choose. Popular nonfiction requests are dictionaries and thesauruses, African American history, Native American studies, GED materials, vocational technical, politics, particularly anarchism, philosophy, art and drawing, psychology, languages, particularly Spanish, and health and fitness. A similarly wide range of fiction styles is requested. Legal materials are generally not available, as we cannot possibly hope to cover the myriad state and federal courts in any depth. The only other subjects we do not cover are the major Western religions, insofar as there are numerous religious-oriented prison projects to which prisoners have access. Books to Prisoners obtains these books primarily through donations from private sources and donated overstock and damaged titles from publishers. Volunteers also purchase materials from yard sales, library sales, and used bookstores. If you are interested in donating any books, please keep in mind the categories mentioned above. Also, most prisons won't accept hardback books. We often have to dispose of well-meaning donations consisting of old school textbooks, obsolete material, and ancient almanacs. If you are either a publisher with overstock or an individual who wishes to send a donation of books, please use Left Bank Distribution's address as a shipping address. 1004 Turner Way East, Seattle, Washington, 98112. Again, that's...
Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to cut in here, because I think, in case folks don't have a pen or pencil, the best thing they can do is for them to give a call, perhaps to your number, or if you don't feel like giving that out, I can give out my number. And if I get any calls from folks interested in contacting these folks, I will definitely pass them on to you.
Okay.
And pass on that address. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's all right.
Because we're running a bit late here. I'm always pretty cranky and possessive about my time. Is there anything you can sum up if you want, though? Go ahead.
All right. Well, I'll just put the last part, is that we strongly believe in the idea of books as learning, mind-opening tools, enabling readers to explore new possibilities in their lives. Our hope is that prisoners will benefit from our program by raising their political and cultural awareness and making their time on the inside more productive. Any donations or funds of relevant books to assist us in our work will be tremendously appreciated.
So if you want to donate books, you want to give your number, Ben, or should I give mine?
Can I give the address first once before?
You can, but again, it's easier.
In case they have been.
But go ahead.
Books to Prisoners, courtesy of Left Bank Books, 92 Pike Street, Box A, Seattle, Washington, 98101.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to have that address repeated, I'm going to make a note of it from Ben, and you can give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. There are plenty of homeless people in the jails, local jail particularly, that need books, although you need to do it actually through, I think, new books. They don't take used books, unfortunately. But this just sounds like a good plan. Give a call to 423-HUF if you want to help prisoners with books. 423-4833. Anything else, Ben?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. And tune again to Ben's show. I guess it'll be coming up 4 o'clock next Thursday. Is that correct?
Yep. Yes.
On Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Thanks for tuning in here. We're just beginning. And I'm actually in a kind of a position of having committed myself, perhaps a little bit too soon, to rebroadcasting a speech by Kathleen Acow. That's one of our local judges, and frankly, I don't have too much good to say about any of our local judges. However, Kathleen Acow was speaking against Proposition 21, which everybody who has any sanity at all opposes. It's actually one of those no-brainers, like opposing the war in El Salvador when that was going on, or the Contras in Nicaragua, or the Nazis in World War II. You know, it's pretty straightforward proposition for most of us. What we really need to look at is how these same people can, for example, who oppose Proposition 21, which is, for those of you who don't know, a proposition that criminalizes young people as though they were adults, can also believe in supporting, if you oppose that, how can you support Shoulder Tap, our local kind of criminalize young people for asking for alcohol. That's, of course, a mystery that only Catherine Byers can unravel. She's the one who pushed this one through the city council, or whose vote, I should say, gave it the winning 4 in the 4-3 majority. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of give you a brief synopsis of Proposition 21. I'm going to start to play this Kathleen Ocow tape, and I want you all to call in if you want me to continue playing it. Because, frankly, I'm glad Kathleen Ocow opposes it, and I'm pleased she spoke against it, this is pretty much preaching to the converted. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. So if I get people calling me saying, please, please play more of this tape, I will. But if otherwise, I'm going to cut it off after about 5 to 10 minutes. First, I'm going to summarize what Proposition 21 is. According to the Mercury News, one of the local rags, juvenile offenders, it mandates adult court trials for juveniles 14 or older charged with murder or certain sex offenses. Gives prosecutors, instead of judges, the power to decide whether juveniles are tried in juvenile or adult court. Requires juveniles to be held in custody until their case is heard, instead of allowing the option of releasing them to parents or residential treatment programs. Does away with informal probation for juveniles and replaces it with deferred entry of judgment, which requires a juvenile to admit to all charges, keep a clean record, and submit to unannounced drug tests and searches for up to 3 years. If the juvenile fails to meet all requirements, the original charge becomes a conviction without a trial. Finally, it requires juveniles convicted of certain violent crimes to serve time in adult prisons. Regarding confidentiality, it allows the police to release the names of juveniles arrested for violent offenses, although charges may later be dropped, and makes criminal juvenile court records public. Gang provisions require gang members convicted of felonies to register with law enforcement for 5 years, allow police to charge gang members with felony conspiracy if a fellow gang member commits a crime, even if they are not present. But you understand that. Mandates a minimum sentence of 1 year in jail for a gang-related misdemeanor and increases sentences for gang-related felonies and reduces the threshold for felony vandalism to $400 in damages. You do $400 in damages, that's a felony, big guy. That's one of those strikes that we've heard so much about. And all you men and women out there, bad news. Three strikes expands the list of three strikes felonies to include extortion, unarmed robbery, arson, and first-degree burglary. This is the Pete Wilson's Revenge, and it's being forwarded by the new Pete Wilson and drag, Democratic drag, that's Gray Davis. And we're going to hear Kathleen Ocow talking about this very shortly, as soon as I get the tape queued up, which will be in about 5 or 10 seconds. Again, call 427-3772. That's our hotline if you think this is a hot enough topic to keep going with. Otherwise, I'm going to switch to something that, to me, is more personal, more relevant, and also more specific to Santa Cruz. Proposition 21 is a proposition that needs to be defeated, but I don't think most people who are listening to this radio station have any doubts on that issue. So here we are. Kathleen Ocow speaking yesterday at the May Garden Restaurant to an audience of largely liberal Democrats.
21, and it is such a very complex piece of legislation, and I am going to confine my comments on it because there are so many different sections. There are 35 separate sections, and if you've had a chance to go through the voters' pamphlet, you can see that it's a very complex issue dealing with a lot of statutory changes that if you are unfamiliar with criminal law or juvenile law, they will probably be very confusing for you. I mean, I had a hard time going through it again last night. So I'm going to confine my remarks to the specific sections that deal with aspects of the juvenile court system, and I'm going to give you my perspective as a juvenile court judge and how these things are going to affect, particularly as I perceive our juvenile court in Santa Cruz County. And I'm going to go through each section and kind of give you a summary of each of the changes. Beginning with Section 12, the first part of the proposition deals primarily with gang-related changes to statutes. Gang enhancement increases the penalties for gang-related crimes, and those are primarily in the adult arena. Beginning with Section 12 is the first section that deals specifically with juveniles, and that deals with the issue of vandalism. It seems like a very big change under that section, but it does have a lot of impact after we go through the different other sections. What this does under Section 12, it increases the penalties from 6 months to 1 year for vandalism. But what the most important thing that it does, and this is a very big change, before a minor could be charged with a felony vandalism, the amount of damages had to be at least $50,000. That threshold has been reduced to $400. So that means that minors with damages for graffiti or whatever, if that amount exceeds $400, that minor will be charged as a felony. And the consequences are going to be greater as we go through the different provisions. Section 18, this is one of the most profound changes from my perspective to the juvenile court statutes, because this now provides for direct filings in adult court for certain specified offenses if the minor is 14 years of age or older. And age 14 will be mentioned throughout some of the changes, the further changes, and I want to just bring to your attention, 14 is kind of a very special age in terms of juveniles. If a minor is under the age of 14, a 13-year-old, they are presumed to be incompetent or unable to understand the wrongfulness of their conduct. There is a presumption regarding that. Now, when they turn 14, that presumption no longer applies. So that's kind of the dividing line in terms of determining whether these children are actually committing crimes is 14 in terms of whether they understand the wrongfulness of their conduct. So that's the changes reflecting the 14-year-old is a very, from my perspective, a very, very vague age, because it's to specify, because we all know that children develop at different ages. And a 13-year-old, let me give you a demonstration of this, because this has happened more than once in my court, and I've always, it always has really struck me about the difference between what a few months can be and the developmental stages of a child. I have had cases where a child may be charged with what we consider a child molest, which is a serious felony. Now, all of the charges that are filed before the petitions are brought before the court, they are basically based on paper, police reports, documents. We never see the child until they actually get to court. And on more than one occasion, I have read a police report regarding a child of an alleged child molest. Now, the elements require touching of a child under the age of 14 in a sexual manner. So that requires some sexual intent on the part of the perpetrator or for the gratification of the victim. I have walked into a courtroom where I have seen a child come in who is 14 years of age, charged with this offense, and been surprised to see what I perceived was an 18-year-old child sitting in the chair with his feet not even touching the ground. And it became very apparent that though the police report reflected a criminal act, that this child was incapable of actually doing that. He wasn't in puberty, he wasn't able to meet the requirements. Now, when we have a direct filing system, we circumvent that process. That child goes directly to the adult court. And that's a real change in how our juvenile system works. It's a very profound change. From my perspective, it really eliminates the checks and balances that are inherent in the juvenile court system that we have. And we have those checks and balances specifically for those kinds of situations, to give the juvenile court judge the discretion to be able to see and make decisions, take into factor in mitigating circumstances in a way that doesn't happen in adult court. The only time you look at mitigating circumstances in adult court is after there's been a conviction and the adult is actually being sentenced. Now, one of the other things that I think a lot of people are not aware of is that SB 344 was enacted by Governor Davis back in October. And a lot of the changes that were part of that legislation are really duplicative of what is proposed in Prop 21. Now, SB 344 already provides for direct filing of 16-year-olds for certain serious offenses. And one of the things that the direct filing would also eliminate is what we call a process called a fitness hearing, that the juvenile court judge has a hearing to determine, in fact, whether that child or whether that minor should be tried as an adult. And it is one of the, I think one of the most important aspects of our juvenile court process.
And you're listening to a recording of Kathleen Akau, a local judge, speaking against Proposition 21, which is coming up in a month for your vote. Yes, that's you out there, you, and you, Ms., Mr., and Miserina America. We have an incoming call. Maybe we'll get some indication of whether this tape should be continued or dumped. Your opinions, please. Call in 427-3772. Well, I'm not sure what that opinion is, except well, here's another one. Let's see what we got.
Free Radio Santa Cruz? Hello?
Well, so we have some uncertain callers or possibly an automatic dialing machine. I'm not sure which. In any case, got to say that this tape, I am told, is going to be replayed on KZSC between 9 and 12. It's either tomorrow morning or a week from tomorrow. For those of you who really are enthusiastic about hearing Kathleen Akau and her well-stated arguments against Proposition 21, but who are going to be disappointed because I'm about to turn away from this tape, not having heard from anybody who's interested in hearing more of this particular judge talking about the tape. I got to say that it's kind of ironic to hear judges coming out for rights and justice, and I'll be talking about that in a moment. We've got an incoming call.
Hello, Free Radio. You're on the air. Speak up. Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Who's speaking?
This is Rose.
Hey, Rose. I guess you called earlier, and you are actually on the line long distance from San Diego, right?
Correct.
And I know that San Diego has a homeless newspaper, Street Light, which has been really doing a great job. I get your paper every month, and I'm really impressed with the kind of stuff you write in, and almost as good as the paper that I contribute to, Street Spirit, up in San Francisco.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, and I guess there's been some... Well, the reason that I wanted to talk to you tonight is because of the killing of William Miller, and I know that you probably have a lot to say about that. Do you want to start wherever you want to start on that issue?
Well, yeah, I was at the vigil, and then I went to the forum later on that evening. But William Anthony Miller Jr. was a 42-year-old male who had been in the Rosecrans area.
As a homeless man?
As a homeless man. In fact, he would do cleaning for the Arby's so that he could, you know, get something to eat, maybe sleep back behind their building. And there was a lot of people that I interviewed, you know, working for Streetlight, that they had just saw the guy the day before. They knew him. He'd been in the area for a long time. And that he was a friendly man. He, you know, he pretty much kept to himself, but he would always give a smile. And one of the ladies, she says, she was on her way to work when she saw the shooting and how it affected her. She says, you know, I don't know why they killed him. The newspaper, the Union Tribune, down here, went from a 3-foot branch to a 4-foot. Branch that had been sharpened at both ends, resembling a spiked baseball bat.
Rose, let me pause here. Pretend that we know nothing about this case.
Okay.
And describe what your understanding is of what happened that, I guess it was Tuesday night?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What time did this killing happen and why?
Well, actually it was in the afternoon.
Sorry, in the afternoon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No? Oh, it was in the morning. Okay. 9:30 in the morning. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being corrected by another colleague.
Right. Now, give us your account of what, as far as you understand, happened, though I know you weren't an eyewitness, right?
Oh, no, I wasn't.
But you heard a number of eyewitnesses speaking about this?
Yes, and basically what they said is that the cops had sicked a dog on him. Okay.
Is it a police dog?
The police officer dog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it went to do its job.
But let me ask you this. How did this begin? How did this contact start?
For some reason, somebody had called the police saying that he was swatting at people, hitting people with this branch.
The branch of a tree?
Right. Mm-hmm. Which nobody had gotten injured or anything at this point.
Was this like in a downtown area? Or?
No, this is the Rosecrans area by the NTC base.
Again, we're
Naval Training Center base.
So this is a wooded area? This is a...
Like no, this is a right across the street is the McDonald's, the Arby, you know, it's a fast food section of town.
Okay. And so here was a man in the morning who apparently was seen kind of wapping around with a limb of a tree, supposedly?
Well, yeah, but originally it was described as a 3-foot branch. Mm-hmm. Okay, originally. It was sharpened. Then it went to, it was a 4-foot branch sharpened at both ends. Mm-hmm. And last description, it was like a baseball bat that was spiked.
Dipped in poison, no doubt.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was totally
Amazon
blown
region.
Out of proportion. And the thing that concerns me from all accounts, okay, is the police officers let
Before you tell us what concerned you, tell us what happened. We still don't know what happened.
Well, from all witness accounts is... The police came upon the situation. They asked him to drop the branch.
How many police officers were there?
From what I'm to understand, there was 5,
mm-hmm.
and only 3 of them shot the victim. The other 2 didn't.
I see. So three officers pulled their guns and shot a guy with a branch.
Right.
And what was he doing? Was he beating to death some young baby on the street or what?
No.
What was he?
At that point, he was not putting down the branch, and they'd already sent the dog out
after
him.
So he was killed for refusing to put down the branch.
Correct.
I see.
Okay. That's actually not it. Okay. The dog coming up behind him, he started running towards the police. They said that he charged them with this branch,
mm-hmm.
and that they feared their life, so they shot him dead and shot their dog.
I see.
Okay. If they had let the dog do his job, The dog would have taken the man down. The dog would not have gotten shot, and the man would not be dead.
Well, it's difficult to believe that 3 grown police officers who are fairly, not I would say heavily armored, but you know who have significant padding on them, can't deal with one man with a branch. Were there other people?
Well, there were 5 of them.
5 of them. Did
5 officers.
Right. Did the 5 claim that they were protecting? Were there any civilians around that were being threatened by?
Well, there was none of them were being threatened, but they were around. But the officer said they feared for their life.
Sounds a little thin to me there.
It is. You know, we have plenty of witnesses. One of the witnesses was the Reverend Glenn Allison,
mm-hmm.
and he is well known for studying mental health. He's also a religious figure.
Did he have any opinions about the mental health? Did he have any opinions about the mental health of the police officers? Because it sounds like you've got some.
Yeah, that's what he was questioning.
It sounds like you have homicidal maniacs in uniforms that are armed with weapons in San Diego, most other cities.
Yeah, that was the thing is that he said it was so apparent that the gentleman was mentally ill. He doesn't understand why it went down the way it did.
By the gentleman, excuse me.
He thinks that they should be. They should have.
The gentleman you're referring to is not any of the police officers who did the shooting, but it's the guy that they shot, right?
Right.
William Miller.
Yeah, they were saying. He was saying, well, it was very apparent that Mr. Miller was mentally ill, but there was no reason you had to kill him. Okay.
Well, maybe he was an eyewitness there. Rose, they regarded themselves as a so-called sort of local adjunct to the SPCA, and they wanted to. Show him how to treat a dog properly. They didn't like the way he was running from the dog. Or how was he reacting to the dog, anyway?
Well, as anybody would have it.
Well, I'm not sure how did he react?
They're showing it right now on Channel 8.
Oh, okay.
The TV.
They were showing the
original.
Mm-hmm. And what are they showing you?
How the lethal weapon, the video from the helicopter, when this all went down.
So there's a video of this entire thing?
Yes, there is. But it's so grainy and so blurry, you really can't tell anything.
They could probably enhance it if they wanted.
Yes, they can.
I understand you had a large protest about this.
Yes, we did. There was, I would say that there was probably about 30 to 50 people, not including, of course, all the news media and radios. And, the group was angry. Because, they're looking at this, and a lot of them had been witnesses, and they couldn't understand why this happened.
Mm-hmm. It happened because certain individuals in blue uniforms are given inordinate amounts of power by a city administration that state law tends to insulate these people from any kind of accountability. In my mind, that's why it happens. What do you think it happens?
Well, I used to work in security, and I found some on that badge, it goes to their head.
Yep.
And I'm not saying to their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it goes to our heads, usually lead-wise.
You know, some of them, they get hardened. You've seen the scandal in L.A. about their police. We've had no doubt that our police force here does have, you know, some bad eggs.
We're talking to Rose of Streetlight from San Diego. Rose, I know that in New York City, the Amadou Diallo, the West Indian immigrant who had 41 bullets fired at him, and was, of course, I'm not sure how many of those, whether it was 18 or 19, he took himself when he went down.
We have one that.
Let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. His killers, those police officers, are currently on trial, though I guess they're doing a kind of a kiss-kiss deal where they're getting, I don't know, second-degree murder charges or some other... essentially, it's a... They're letting, in my mind, letting police officers off with less than ordinary citizens would have gotten when they need to actually to be somewhat more severe with the police, because the police in this situation, you know, have a history of violence, particularly in New York City.
Yeah.
A whole series of incidents have happened. So it took a lot of protest to get Amadou Diallo's killers even on trial. The mayor of New York City, Rudolph Giuliani, as you probably know, not our favorite guy, he put them back on the job 2 months after they had shot this man dead, this unarmed black man dead, for reaching for a wallet to show them his ID without a warning. Now, this being the case, what happened was, in order to get these officers prosecuted, it took protests every day. It took dozens, I think it may have been like hundreds of protesters, certainly at least scores of arrests, for the Giuliani to say, okay, we're going to put these people on trial. And I guess I'm hoping that maybe that protest kind of situation is beginning in San Diego.
Well, we're starting to get very upset because I think it was a week before Mr. Miller. There was a young woman, 20 years old, and she was black, and she was pregnant, and she was shot and killed by the police.
What was her name?
And they said it was over a gun, but there was no gun found.
It was a disappearing gun.
Yeah. You know.
What was her name?
Oh, I really don't know.
I'd like to find it out if you can.
I'll try to.
Sure.
But we have cases all the time, but we've had four or five shootings now since the first of the year.
Well, in our local San Jose, that last year there were 7 fatal shootings, and I'm not aware that any police officers were disciplined, much less have brought up on criminal charges.
Well, it's like, I'm not sure exactly, but it's like 342 cases have been brought before the review board here, and 340 of them have been dismissed. 440, excuse me.
Well, that's because you got such a good police force.
You know, that's why we're asking for independent boards that are elected boards,
mm-hmm.
okay, to look into, you know, in the community, to look into the situations. Instead of it being, you know, basically they're told by the police, you know, what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the police are still getting off on this.
Well, I know in Los Angeles, Margaret Mitchell, another homeless woman, was attacked and killed by police officers last May, I guess it was. As she was, her lethal weapon was a screwdriver and a shopping cart, I believe.
Mm.
And the LAPD quickly sealed, signed, and buried that case. But unfortunately, with the Rampart scandal, and the fact that Rampart's being a station in LA where the police are just apparently so out of control that even one police officer turned state's evidence, a guy named Perez, and has been ratting out his fellow criminal police officers, because that's what they are, criminal cops, who have concocted and planted evidence, shot people. Beaten people regularly in an expanding scandal that the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors, the City Council in Los Angeles, is still refusing to call for an independent investigation.
Yeah, I read about that in the paper today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it was like our police shot a homeless man with a glue gun.
Where was this?
This was last year.
Oh, boy.
Okay, another man.
Do you know his name?
Cane.
a man with a cane.
Who I knew the man. He was always going, you know, into the food line.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if you got too close, he'd shake that stick at you, you know, that cane, and let you know, hey, don't come any closer.
Mm-hmm.
And they shot him
mm-hmm.
with a cane. I mean, they haven't been trained?
Apparently not.
You know, because, like I said, you know, I worked security, and we were trained to defuse the situation.
Well, you know, it's very nice to hear people call for training for police officers, but I think some convictions would go a nice long way.
Well, that,
and some
and
heavy lawsuits, you know.
After a situation like this, take a psychological eval.
Well, there's all kinds of things. They hire killer cops from other jurisdictions. This is what goes on. A cop, you know, uses excessive force or even lethal force against somebody, like up in San Francisco with Aaron Williams. Then he gets hired across the bay. He gets sent. He doesn't get convicted of anything. There are no serious black marks on his record, apparently. He just gets transferred to another jurisdiction where it's business as usual.
Yeah.
You know, we had the case of Charles Vaughn Jr., a black individual who was labeled mentally ill, former activist, shot on the roof for having a corkscrew in his hand. After being pepper sprayed twice, he advanced toward the officer, and the officer had told the man on the street below, who was his co-officer, if he moves toward me, cap him, meaning kill him. And he was shot dead on the roof of the seaside roof back, I guess it was a year ago, maybe even 2 years ago now. I'm a little bit unclear on the time, but you know, the request that they were making was, oh, let's set up a task force to train police officers in mental health tactics. But frankly, I got to tell you, what's really needed is significant community control of police at all levels, so that you don't have a group of people who, oh, because they're mentally ill, you know, maybe they get some special treatment. I think we all should get special treatment, but I particularly think that there has to be an end to the kind of blank checks that are given to the police, and the lack of accountability and the lack of any kind of prosecution. This is the first time in New York City these four men who shot dead this unarmed black West Indian, Amadou Diallo, the first time there's been any murder charges ever leveled against police officers that I'm aware of. At least that's according to the stories I've been reading earlier this evening. Rose, I've got to roll pretty quickly, but is there something more you want to sum up with?
Just that I really do think that America needs to wake up. That you know, this is wrong, and we need to speak out against it. We need to change it.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I thank you for letting me speak.
Hey, listen, and if you write anything about this, I'll be happy to help put it out to other homeless newspapers. I'm really glad that Streetlight is taking an interest in this issue. I mean, I'm sure it would. I couldn't see that it, you know, any way that it wouldn't. But give my regards to everybody down there, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again about their giveaway of the Naval Training Center. Naval property that should be homeless property in the sense that it should be used for affordable housing, just like the Presidio in San Francisco and the Wherry housing up there should be used, but instead it's either being gentrified or demolished, and it's a criminal behavior by the authorities. Again, they're the real criminals, the ones in power.
Am I correct in this, that there is an estimated 500,000 homeless people in California?
You know, I've heard homeless people estimated, and the standard kind of catchphrase is 1-3% of the population. I think
because we're seeing it,
that would say that
more and more down here. There is no rent control down here, and anybody who's on welfare or below, like GR, SSI, Social Security, they're becoming homeless.
Yeah, I mean the escalating rents are sort of like these. It's producing this kind of fat cat dog fight where the rich are driving out the less rich. You don't even have to be poor to lose your house. I mean, to get priced out of a neighborhood. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I appreciate your calling, Rose. I'm going to roll, but
okay,
thank you
later.
Very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Rose from Streetlight down in San Diego, California, live on the air on Free Radio Santa Cruz. 96.3 FM. Our lines are open again at 427-3772. So if you really want to hear more of that judge talking, you got to give me a call and let me know. In the meantime, I'm going to refer to an incident that happened, gosh, it was the day before yesterday. There were 23 of us over in San Jose, and for some reason the police just had to arrest us. What were we doing? Grand theft? beating up passersby, possibly vandalizing. No, no. We were arrested for supporting the rights of the homeless in San Jose, and I'm going to read you the press release we put out on that issue, and probably somewhere down the line play you some tape on it. It was the second such protest. And here's the press release. 23 arrested at San Jose City Hall. Mayor Gonzalez orders council in recess. San Jose, California. In a second action of Reverend Scott Wager's Poor People's Campaign, 23 people were arrested in San Jose City Council chambers Tuesday evening as they stood before the public microphone waiting for a reply from Mayor Ron Gonzalez, announcing they were ready to use the nonviolent civil disobedience tactics of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The Community Homeless Alliance Ministry led the group in prayer as Mayor Gonzalez and his 8 fellow council members declared a recess and vacated the chamber. They were replaced by 17 policemen who used pain compliance holds on several of the protesters to force them to move. Nearly 100 supporters showed up of all ages and colors, of all walks of life, to pray and sing in the San Jose Council chambers as the police led the San Jose 23 away into custody. Wagers, that's the name of the reverend who headed the protest and who got most of us together, Reverend Scott Wagers, and the protesters demanded that Mayor Gonzalez commit himself to immediate action to address the lack of affordable housing, critical lack of shelter space, and inadequate services for the 20,000 homeless people on the streets in Silicon Valley. Gonzalez offered the protesters a downstairs meeting with an aide and motel vouchers for the night. Not enough for the protesters. Mayor Ron Gonzalez was last visited by Community Homeless Alliance Ministry congregation members and supporters on January 26th, when the delegation waited fruitlessly for 3 hours for the mayor to appear. Gonzalez has steadfastly refused to meet with, to reply to, or to agendize any action on the City Council agenda on affordable housing, in spite of huge expenditures on gentrification projects. Community Homeless Alliance Ministry has called for the city, 1, to immediately provide shelter for all homeless people on the streets of San Jose, 2, to allocate $5 million to a Housing for Families program, and 3, to establish a realistic long-range housing policy for the city. Kind of a drop in the bucket for San Jose, which is the largest city in Northern California. It has around 1 million people. Among those arrested were Adrian Lawton, Pastor Larry Sweeney, Judith Light, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris, your host tonight, Homeless Mom, Christy Wong, Lennox Sweeney, Sandy Perry, Nancy Nichols Chase, Roy Stevens, Paul Schusser, Albert Sandoval, Reverend Scott Wagers, and 11 others, including a disabled man in a wheelchair. Reverend Wagers vowed to return for a third time to City Hall in 2 or 3 weeks in greater numbers if Mayor Ron Gonzalez does not act. Accusing the mayor of indifference to the San Jose poor, Wagers said there must be a change in the city's priorities. Resources must be found to meet the needs of those forced to live on the streets in one of the wealthiest cities in the state. Many renters also face the specter of eviction because of prohibitive rent increases and housing speculation. The San Jose 23 were cited for disrupting a public meeting, a misdemeanor carrying penalties of up to 6 months in jail and or a $1,000 fine. They were released the same evening on their promise to appear in court in early March. So that's what I was doing on Tuesday night. I seem to be collecting tickets over there in San Jose, and these are for trials that actually may lead to jail, because I am not one who usually agrees to take probation, which is an alternative to jail. Usually what a judge does when he or she offers probation is they say, if you agree to obey all laws for a period of, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, then you don't have to go to jail. But at any time during that period you violate the law, then you may be sentenced for up to the original amount of the sentence. So that means that on the last day of that 3-year probation period, if I engage in a public protest and a police officer accuses me of violating the law, I can be taken to court. I can be not even given a jury trial, just given a hearing before a judge, and jailed for the entire length of the sentence. And that can be done without there even being a proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard required in a jury trial. I don't get a jury of 12 people who have to agree that I'm guilty. I don't get this, the agreement that they have to decide I'm guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Rather, a single judge will make a decision if there is a, it's either clear and convincing evidence or preponderance of the evidence that I violated the law. It's a very risky proposition. And these kinds of chains and these kinds of ropes and ties hold a lot of people in California. A lot of people are on probation. And for those of us who may come into contact with the police, as every day I may do, I, for example, when I was over in San Jose on my way back from that protest, I was released on my own recognizance, given a ticket, told to appear in court on this misdemeanor charge in mid-March, which I will do in San Jose. I saw police officers stopping some folks in a Cadillac, and I stopped the car, took out my tape recorder, walked over and stood near the car to determine what was going on. As it happened, the police officer was actually just dealing with a mechanical problem with the car. It was no abusive behavior by the cop, or at least not apparently, and we had an interesting conversation with the folks in the car. But I could have been arrested for anything, and even having a police contact can be the basis for a probation violation. Something that, for example, contact with police is not normally the case for ordinary citizens. You're allowed to contact the police. It may not be a pleasant experience, but it's one that's permitted. So probation is a risky thing. We have an incoming call here.
You're on free radio.
Hello, Uncle Robert. I'm can't hear your show, so I'm flying blind here.
Ah, this is David Silva.
Yes.
And David, I know you've been involved in the progressive and rolling fasts here to end the sleeping ban,
yeah,
or set up safe sleeping zones, or, I don't know, wake up the city council. How would you describe it?
Decriminalization of sleep, which, of course, the solution to that is safe sleeping zones. They're starting to realize the solution, but they don't dare speak the words. Repeal sleeping ban is not to be even spoken in this progressive town that has such a reactive mode on this issue.
Sleeping ban, it's such a bizarre thing.
It's a bizarre thing.
How can you ban sleeping?
Yes.
I mean, come on.
So all we are saying is give sleep a chance. So Tuesday night, I want everybody to come to City Council and sing with me. All we are saying is give sleep a chance. And we may do a little demonstration Tuesday night, mm-hmm, open microphone, mm-hmm, if somebody feels like singing. Also, we have a press conference Wednesday noon. Every Wednesday noon in front of City Hall, I hand out petitions on the Safe Sleeping Zones Decriminalization of Sleep initiative.
That's not a hokey proposition where you're just asking for people's opinion. This would actually put it on the ballot.
This would actually would make an ordinance change so that the camping ordinance becomes a camping ordinance, not an anti-homeless, anti-sleeping law.
Mm-hmm.
Not much in the way of creating camping grounds and camping spaces, but it begins the process of making it, you know, shaping it so that it stops the human rights violation, the institutional hate crime that it is. We'd like people to show up for that press conference because as next Wednesday, as you may know, Robin Lieberman begins going on full fast.
Robin is, of course, a UCSC student who, along,
yes,
with Roxana Kistapache,
yeah,
I guess they're both doing this. Last January, last month they took two meals a day. This month they're taking one meal, and I guess next month it's no meals. Is that the plan? Or?
Yeah, starting March 1st, those eight of us that are on Progressive Fast, some of them are on slow Progressive Fast, which means they started late, which means they probably won't go into full fast until April.
Mm-hmm.
I want everybody to do this safely. But we'll have eight people, and we are going on full fast, but Robin Lieberman is going on full fast next Wednesday. She's going a week ahead of us.
Can't keep a good woman down.
Can't keep a good woman down, and she's one of the best we got in town. And I would like all 70 people that are on the Rolling Fast to show up, and we'll have a group photo to try to get the press there. There's some 70 people now that are in the Rolling Fast.
Now, Rolling Fast, of course, is where you announce you're not going to be eating for a day or sleeping for a night.
Or sleeping for a day, yeah.
And you call the city council, tell them that, and then tell them afterward with the second,
yeah,
call how that went.
Now, for those people who have not been able to get a hold of me or who I have not been able to get a hold of, who haven't been assigned a particular day, your day is officially February 29th. You'll be sharing it with Michael Smith. So anybody, the catch-up day will be February 29th. We'll call that just a day of fast from either food
now,
or
wait
sleep.
A minute. Is there a February 29th?
Yes, there is a February 29th, Robert.
Really? Is there an Easter Bunny?
Easter Bunny may be bringing meals to those of us who finally will be allowed to break our fast when the city council finally takes a heart shift. It doesn't take an intellectual shift. This takes a heart shift.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we have to do it this way, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of weak today.
I'm not only cutting back on my breakfast, you know, cutting back and eating only breakfast this month, but I've decided that I need to be ready for March 1st. I'm slowly cutting down my portions. Mm-hmm. And I ran around a little bit today, so I'm kind of weak. I'm going to have to sign off for now.
Mm-hmm.
But know that I will survive, and the sleeping band will not.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Okay.
Carry on.
Sure thing, my friend.
Bye-bye.
And the sleeping ban, of course, one of our most stupid and unappealing laws in Santa Cruz, and one which I've wasted so many hours denouncing, is that law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep outside or in a vehicle after 11 o'clock at night on pain of a $54 fine. For all you newcomers to the radio, yes, indeed, it's illegal to sleep if you're homeless in Santa Cruz late at night. Why? Hey, go ask Mike Rutkin. He's one of our council members who still supports that law. In fact, you might say the entire council in its way supports the law or isn't willing to stand up and publicly advocate against it. Even Mayor Keith Sugar, who has... modifications to the law that would have made it more reasonable and was voted down, apparently felt it so crucial to his political career not to raise the issue in any disruptive or uncomfortable way that he's refused to bring up the issue or allow it to be discussed in city council on the agenda.
You're on free radio.
Hi, Uncle Robert. David again. I forgot to mention we were handing out cards all over town. We're having a call-in, all-call City Hall, to put decriminalization of sleep on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody call 420-5020, and when you get the machine, you push 1, and that gets you to the entire City Council. If you call during the daytime, say you want to leave a message for the entire City Council, but call tonight, because they're forming the agenda now. And also, Catherine Byers personally told me that she was the swing vote on this. So her home number is 426-6108. And ask her, you know, what's holding her up. Her supposed reason is that she's afraid that they'll lose the next election, and the reality is the coalition will be fractured now if they don't do something, and they'll lose the next election. So that's already a reality. But they need to mend this coalition, and she needs to get off the duff. It's really all up to her.
Mm-hmm.
We could start begging Michael Hernandez. He seems to be making a lot of friendly noises, but I'd rather persuade Catherine Byers. So her home number is 426-6108. Give her a call and ask her what the hell's wrong with her, you know. She promised this, and she's breaking her promise because of phony elections and all this kind of bullshit. So 420-5020, call City Hall, tell them to put decriminalization of sleep on the agenda.
I agree.
Want it on the agenda. We want it on the agenda Tuesday night.
Well, thank you, David.
Thank you, Robert.
All right.
Yes, it's that old City Council 24-hour line, 420-5020, 420-5020. And as David Silva has told you, and it's also in the book, so we're not revealing any big secrets, council member and shadow mayor Catherine Byers' phone number is 426-6108. If you want to call and ask her why she thinks it should be illegal for a certain class of people to sleep in our town, is that some sort of... did she have problems when she was a child with homeless people? What is it? They're actually, if I had David in the studio, I would be talking with him about the Schmidt proposal, which some of you may know. Michael Schmidt, the Chamber of Commerce CEO, strangely enough, was the only one to come forward with a plan for safe sleeping zones. I mean, actually, a lot of us came forward with plans. He's the only person of a high-profile, prestigious... I don't even say conservative bent. He is conservative, but part of the establishment in the city just got tired. He got so upset when he heard about the violence being committed against homeless people. Stats revealed by the police chief and publicized in the Santa Cruz Sentinel on January 13th showed that homeless people were getting beaten at a rate of 40 to 100 times that of people in their houses. And since most assaults are not reported, the figure is probably like hundreds of times those of people in their houses. And this is partially, it can be blamed by a number of factors, but one consideration is that people, when they go to sleep, and some people are getting beaten at night in their sleep, and were last year and still are, is because they can't sleep in safe zones. That is to say, not zones that are patrolled by police necessarily, but zones where they can, where groups of people can sleep together, where if they are attacked, they can call the police and file complaints and describe their assailants without fear themselves of getting tickets or jail or getting ticketed or taken away for past warrants. It's connected to the sleeping ban, and I brought this up before the Citizens Police Review Board at one point when I was still talking to them, because why should the police be in a position to enforce laws that criminalize basic human needs and that make it impossible for people to report violations of health and safety? It puts the homeless in a position where they're completely vulnerable to assault because they start getting criminalized by these laws, and so they can't use the police. Now, I don't wish to seem like a Pollyanna. I don't think the homeless people would use the police anyway in many cases because of the way police treat homeless people and because of the status homeless people have in our society, the lack of credibility they have, as we've all seen documented on this show time and time again. I do a lot of interviews from the streets for all you newcomers, and police treat homeless people differently than they treat other people. Homeless people get treated with suspicion, with hostility. Their normal behavior, what is normal for a person in a house, is not considered to be normal for a homeless person or not permissible. And we all know that there is a class line that is drawn here. The sleeping ban really kind of exemplifies it. And I certainly echo David Silva in his initiative to repeal the sleeping ban, at least in part. It's a very moderate initiative. It just talks about safe sleeping zones in non-residential, non-downtown, non-beachfront areas. So there's plenty of places where it's still illegal to be at night if people feel uncomfortable that someone's sleeping there. But for the first time, it establishes places where it's legal to be. Anyway, Schmidt has come off with a plan. He originally proposed making it legal to sleep in the police station parking lot and the county parking lot near the court building, and also in parking lot structure number 10, which is the second and third floors of that structure, which is near Hobie's Restaurant, near Wells Fargo Bank. It's between River and Front Streets. And, of course, Downtown Association immediately raised a hue and cry, oh, no, and there are no sprinklers in there. That's the excuse for dumping that idea. Police chief didn't like the idea of having people sleeping in his parking lot, even though nobody was using it at night. And they said, oh, no, that'll attract all the bad elements. You can't have that. So that was dumped. And as for the county, apparently people went to scan, or Michael Schmidt went to scan, Santa Cruz Action Network, the organization or machine, some say, that elected the current city council majority. That's the sleeping ban majority that currently makes it criminal for homeless people to sleep, unanimously voted last March to keep it a $54 fine for people to sleep at night. Thank you very much. Schmidt went to them, and Schmidt's proposal essentially has been reduced to, I guess, the hope that the county will do something in their parking lot, and also they're discussing going to the state and asking Governor Gray Davis to allow them to use the Armory parking lot, which I suppose any parking lot is better than no parking lot, but this is at the end of a dangerous kind of windy road. It's in a barbed wire kind of concentration camp atmosphere up there. There's all kinds of problems. Anyway, I'm actually going to be meeting with Michael Schmidt tomorrow to give him my thoughts on this issue. And I want to say that Schmidt has to be given my vote of approval, not for any particular plan he's put forward, but for his general assertion that there have to be safe sleeping zones for homeless people. He could have laid low and said nothing because the city council has been utterly gutless on this issue and made it not just gutless. Mayor Sugar has acted like a thug around the whole matter by essentially shutting down his own homeless issues task force, which told him on December 6th in an emergency resolution, you have to put this on the agenda for the Christmas vacation. We need to have our proposal, which is suspend the sleeping and camping bans until you can set up safe zones. You cannot make it illegal for people to sleep. It's something they have to do. And it also is a significant public safety issue, and the shelters are full. During a significant portion of time this winter, I would say for at least half the nights, according to Ken Cole, I haven't gotten the latest figures, but it was certainly true for 3 weeks in January, there was no room at the inn, folks. So everyone else had to sleep outside illegally and face criminalization for it. So Schmidt came forward and said this is wrong. He started going from one neighborhood group to the next, advocating. He has been able according to what he's told me, to get the Downtown Association to unanimously vote in favor of safe sleeping zones. Again, of course, the question is where, but I guess he's got them to okay the idea of the De La Vega Armory and the county building, and also possibly a proposal for permits for vehicles, so people could sleep in their vehicles somewhere. This is a teeny tiny first step, but it is a step, and I think that it's time that, and he apparently has talked to council members who've all agreed, five individually have all kind of agreed when they talk to him, okay, it sounds like a good idea, and maybe they'll introduce something like that at city council. Then, of course, the question is going to rise, is it a good proposal in terms of the particulars that come up? And that's going to be important. But until there is a particular plan that does involve that does involve real campground shelter space for the homeless people that are in our city, it has to be true that it cannot be a crime for people to sleep where they must. And that, I think, is the bottom line we have to stand with David Silva on. That means calling 420-5020. That's the thing to say. It says, until there are adequate, safe sleeping zones established, we want you to decriminalize sleeping. Suspend laws that make basic human needs criminal. Why send these people through an endless trek to the courts to raise the necessity defense, which is what they will have to do? Why put them in fear at night? Why have them have to gravitate to areas that are unsafe? That is wrong. And I guess I'm tired of saying it. So I say you should say it out there in Radio Land. Say it to the authorities at 420-5020. And say it on Wednesday when you come to David Silva's press conference at noon. And say it on Tuesday night at City Council at 7 o'clock.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Hi, Robert North. This is Wanda Conaway-Knight. How you doing?
Hey, Wanda. You been listening?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. I know we talked to you. You're a woman of color who got the big hassle down at the boardwalk and actually were separated from your child forcibly a couple years ago, right?
Yes, that's right.
So go ahead.
It was May 31st, 1998.
Wow. I know you told us this had to do with the fact that you were talking about, in a negative way, about the Ku Klux Klan, and you were told by one of the local seaside thugs in uniform that that was an inappropriate kind of comment about the Klan.
Yeah, he told me that I cannot disrespect an organization like that up there. He was a seaside security guard.
Wow, I remember that. I mean, I remember you're discussing that on the air. How far has it? Has that gotten anywhere? Have you got some sort of civil lawsuit going?
Yes, I have with Katie Wells.
Uh huh.
We filed it, and they were served.
Are they? Have they kind of abandoned their Klan hoods for some other garb, or?
Oh, I don't know, but I had to fill out this interrogation paper.
Oh, well, what was that?
They wanted to know where I went to high school at, where I lived,
mm-hmm.
The jobs I had.
They being, the other side in the lawsuit, the Seaside Company?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me a stack of papers for me and my son.
I see.
Because he's my co-defendant.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty ridiculous.
I see. So they're really trying to make you let it all hang out, embarrass you, make it as difficult as possible for you to proceed, perhaps.
Yeah.
So how much are you suing them for?
I don't know. That's up to Katie Wells. Whatever she feels is right.
Uh-huh.
Which is, there's a new act. It's called the Ralph Act.
The who act?
The Ralph Act.
Like Ralph Crampton?
Yeah, and
Ralph.
The Bland Act. I just found this out from watching something on C-SPAN.
Uh-huh.
And it's about how they won't get jail time, but you can get monetary comfort. We can get compensation for what you do. In other words, you can sue them and get money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they can't. I mean, in order for them to get jail time, they would have to be taken into court by the district attorney, and that's going to happen sometime never. You know, since the Seaside Company is one of the biggest money makers in town and one of the biggest economic powerhouses, I don't think Ron Ruiz is going to offend those folks over there.
No, and the funny thing about it is that my daughter knows one of his grandchildren.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She went to school with her up at San Lorenzo High School.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like one of those southern towns where, you know, you remember how your ancestors used to play with the, I'm assuming that your folks are from the south at some point.
West Virginia.
They were, of course, they broke off from Virginia in the Civil War, but I imagine some of your ancestors were held in slavery?
To my knowledge, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, there's this business of how the the white folks and the white kids and the black kids all played together on the plantation, but there's a sort of a different story for the two different sides of the fence, right?
Yeah.
Well, so have you got something you wanted to talk about particularly? That
yeah, well, I have also a federal right civil lawsuit against Deputy Martin Beltran at the Felton substation.
He's a sheriff's deputy?
Yes, he is.
What did he do?
Let me see. False arrest, police brutality, pepper sprayed me in the face, 2 inches away from my face, 3 weeks after I had first degree and second degree burns on it.
Wow. When did this happen?
This happened November of last year.
And what were the circumstances, Wanda?
I called in for this woman that I was staying at her house, and she was robbing from me, or stealing stuff from me. And I called the Felton substation for help. And they sent Deputy Beltran down on me.
And what time, was this at night or in the morning?
It was at night.
And what happened?
And, me and the woman, she was trying to get me off the phone, and some way her finger got cut. So they came in the house, tried to get me to go with them, and I was afraid to go with Deputy Beltran.
Had you known him from before?
Yes, I have.
And what kind of, had you had previously had bad experience with him?
Yes, going against the judge's court order for visitations of my son with my ex-husband who happened to be white, or excuse me, Caucasian.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So he had been involved in this court dispute? I'm sorry. So had you had some physical abuse before, or you just felt he was prejudiced? What was the situation?
Well, I just felt that he was after me.
I see.
Because that's the fourth time that I had encounters with him.
These were encounters that he initiated, or?
Yeah, he stopped me. The day I got thrown off the boardwalk, that night, he stopped me and told me there was a warrant for my arrest. And I'm saying, what are you talking about?
So as a woman of color driving in Felton, you find yourself stopped a number of times by police, perhaps more than one might consider would be natural?
How about 11 times in 6 weeks? Or just about 11 times, almost? For no reason, all they did was give me a citation and want to know where I was moving to.
You filed
they never gave me a citation, excuse me.
Sure.
They just wanted to know where I was moving.
Well, maybe they find you so good-looking. it's interesting. This sounds like what we call a federal civil rights violation. Have you tried taking this into the federal courts?
With him, his case is going to federal civil rights. And I've called Michelle Alexander, the racial justice lawyer from the ACLU in Sacramento and in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. I know Michelle
Alexander. The Democratic Renewal in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
The Bay Area Police Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Every major NAACP around the United States.
And what do they tell you?
Good luck, and they documented it down and tell me that it's really good that I have a paper trail. Mm-hmm. I've spoke with Angela Davis and her sister, Fania Davis, who is a lawyer. Cecil B. William Glide Memorial Church up in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having this long paper trail.
Mm-hmm. You talked to Mel Mason in Seaside?
No.
Good person to call. He's very active around police misconduct. I'll give you his number off air, or you might give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423.
Yeah, I called earlier, and they gave me this one.
Oh, good. Well, call back, and they'll try to give you Mel's number.
And I also have a mistaken identity that has been placed on me by somebody in the county, because the DA's office keeps telling me I'm this woman from L.A.
She has the same name you do, right?
Yeah, but this is my married name, not my maiden name. And when I came out here almost 21 years ago, June 21st of 78, I was Wanda Renita Conaway, and I didn't marry Mr. Knight till January 8th, 1990. And I went to court a few weeks ago, and I was in front of Superior Court Judge Art Danner.
Uh-oh.
And, it was for a fine, and I want a continuation of the fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that there was another matter I'd like to speak about, and it was about this mistaken identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I was born Wanda Renita Conaway. I lived in East Rutherford, New Jersey. I didn't come out here till June 21st, 1978. But they have a mistaken identity on me that since 1972, that Wanda Knight has been doing B&E, armed robbery, and in and out of prison.
So they keep confusing you with her. Huh?
Yeah. And I told them, how can that be when I didn't marry Mr. Knight until January 8th, 1990? And how could an agency, with the DA's office, I went up there, they keep telling me I'm this person, how can they make the mistake when I was married in this county, my children were born in Santa Cruz, I got my tickets here, I've been on welfare here, I've been Cabrillo College, I've never lived anywhere in California but here, in Santa Cruz area, mm-hmm. Santa Cruz and Felton.
And when's the last time they misidentified you as this other Wanda Knight person?
Let me see. I'm trying to think.
Within the last year? Or?
Yeah. Not within the last year, but when I went up there August 4th to complain about this woman who I called in from Robin for me, she stole a very personal tape that was made 10 years ago by me and my ex-husband when I was 8.5 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And she was showing it to minors. And she was in jail with a dirty pee test. And I went. It was August 4th, and I went to court. And then I went up to the DA's office, and then I went to the sheriff's department to file a complaint against this woman.
Mm-hmm.
She already had 2 convictions, possession of stolen property, but yet I was told that I cannot file a complaint on her. I cannot press charges.
Because?
It's up to the DA.
Well, it is true that it is up to the, you can always file a complaint.
Yeah, I filed a complaint.
But it's up to the DA whether he wants to prosecute it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that woman already had 2 strikes, plus she has other strikes on her,
mm-hmm.
and that's contributing to delinquency of minors and possession of stolen property.
But getting back to the case of the deputy, because I think that a lot of these other issues, which are important to you,
mm-hmm.
can be obscure because we don't know what the facts are in all of them.
Okay.
But if you're telling us that a deputy came up and pepper sprayed you, and a deputy that has stopped you for seemingly simply being a woman of color driving in Felton,
mm-hmm.
that to many people seems to be pretty outrageous, I would think. It certainly does to me.
Well, it is pretty outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I kept asking when I got stopped, I said, what are you stopping me for? Why are you stopping me?
Have you filed complaints about this? Or?
I filed...
Not that it's going to do any good, mind you. But
no, but with that one deputy, I filed 3 complaints with the Board of Supervisors against him for $3,200,000. Of course, I was denied.
Mm-hmm.
So Katie Wells, we took it over to the Federal Civil Rights Court in San Jose.
Mm-hmm. And that's now proceeding?
Yes, it is.
So I'm sorry, you say that... So this guy came, and you were going to tell me the circumstances of this pepper spraying that happened.
I called the Felton substation on this woman. Her name is Linda Swanson, for stealing from me. They came there, and they arrested me for resisting arrest and battery.
How many officers were there?
2 of them.
And one of them was Deputy Beltran?
Yes.
And how do you spell that name?
B-L-T-R-A-N, Beltran.
Beltran?
Beltran, yeah.
Sorry, Beltran, not... And the circumstances were, resisting arrest, of course, is a favorite charge of various police jurisdictions, mm-hmm. because they don't have to give an underlying charge. I mean, they... And, you know, it's a nice thing to drag you into custody, gives them an opportunity to handcuff you, and if they want to abuse you, they can abuse you a bit. You get to spend time in jail, from their point of view, maybe over the weekend, and then the charge disappears, or,
7
you know...
days. I spent in jail.
Did you? Whatever happened to that resisting arrest charge?
Oh, they dropped the charges.
Of course.
And not just that. After they pepper sprayed me and my face was on fire because I still had open wounds from the first degree and second degree burns, they took me outside of this home and they hosed me down.
Wow.
Yeah. And
it sounds like something out of the South.
Oh, it's like something out of the Twilight Zone.
Sounds like Deputy Clark has moved to Santa Cruz, or maybe he never left.
Maybe
from Selma, Alabama.
But, you know, I'm not the only case that people have been abused by the authorities or harassed,
I agree.
Or brutally attacked.
Mm-hmm.
I have people coming to me with reports, and I'm trying to contact people in Sacramento and people outside of the state that are with the civil rights movement.
Do you want to, how has the local NAACP responded to your concerns?
Well, they just talk about it, but they don't have money to help me with an attorney, but... Katie Wells is doing this case pro bono.
How about ACLU? How are they treating it?
No, they don't have money either.
They don't have money, and they don't seem to have the will to do anything. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that they didn't, you know, the ACLU here, when it gets together, can do something, but
mm-hmm.
they choose usually not to get together, and I haven't seen too much NAACP action either, although I haven't been on that scene too much. They did come to the Citizens Police Review Board back in, I guess, November and December to ask the Citizens Police Review Board to ask the City Council to have a law that would make it, you know, that would deal with racial profiling, so that when people were stopped, you would make note of their color and you would make note of why a stop was being made, so that we could see if police officers are engaging in the kinds of stops that you say that deputies are doing with you up in Felton, which sound like, well, maybe it's something personal with you, but is this a racial thing, or is this, what is this?
Well, I don't know, but I do know that a close friend of mine who lives up in Felton, and she's also a woman of color,
uh-huh.
and she is now going to employ Katie Wells to help her with the sheriff's department, and I would like to try to get these people together to have a class action suit.
Well, maybe would you like to give a number for people to call?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
My number is 465-0276.
465-0276. 76. We're talking to Wanda
Conaway Knight.
Wanda Conaway Knight, and that's not Wanda Knight, that's Wanda Conaway Knight, to distinguish her from armed robbers and other folks who are by the same name, or people used to have that reputation with the police. Give it the number. Give us the number again, Wanda, so people can call you. If you've suffered police misconduct, particularly if you're a person of color, you don't have to be a person of color, I would assume.
Just a person, anybody,
any
all
person.
Of color.
Right. Whatever color you are. Mm-hmm. What's your number again, Wanda?
465-02-76. Yeah, and it will say on the machine, this is the Robbins Family Home. I'm a program manager for 6 mentally disabled ladies, and I'm also licensed by the state of California. And when I got licensed, that mistaken identity came through, too. Every time I go for a job, I have to prove who I'm not. But like Art Danner told me, the thing to do is go to the agencies with my birth certificate, my Social Security card, and my maiden name and my married name, which starts with 140 from New Jersey, and that the agency should stop this.
And has that been successful?
No. I looked at him. He goes, what agency is doing this? And I said, the one upstairs, the DA's office. And this started when he was a DA.
He has been the DA, really, for 20 years before he got promoted to judge.
Yeah.
Well, Wanda, I want to thank you for being on the air. Is there anything you want to conclude with?
No, but I want to thank you, Robert, because you've been following my case for a long time on my problems that I'm having in this county, and I really appreciate your support.
Hey, I appreciate you raising these issues, Wanda.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And I'll call you for that number.
Okay.
Okay.
Do it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your Thursday evening host, Robert Norris. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. And the call-in number, in case you didn't catch it, is 427-3772. We want you to call in. Talk to us about the sleeping ban, police abuse, other experiences you think would be important around issues of civil rights for folks who are poor, human rights for folks who are poor. Today I visited for the first time in about a year and a half the Dolphin Lee Complex. These are apartment complexes in the Beach Flats that are targeted by City Council for demolition. And supposedly that site will then become the basis of affordable housing that will then give new and better and cleaner and more upscale apartments to those who are currently living in squalor, as Tim Fitzmaurice might describe it, or in distressed housing. Perhaps that's a better way to put it, and to use his words. I went down there to talk to some of the tenants and to get to talk to other folks there as well to get some idea what's going on, because over the weekend the city has sent in inspectors to look over complaints that they got, and I read a 3-page listing of the complaints by some of the tenants. I'd hope to get word back from the Western Service Workers that apparently has been kind of compiling these complaints, and I'm the first to say that landlords need to pay attention to complaints from tenants, and that we as tenants, and I'm one of them, need to get together and stop landlord speculation, landlord exploitation, wherever it happens. Beach Flats, West Side, New York City, I don't care. The landlord racket is a bad one, and I'm 100% behind the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, for instance. Donna Dice, who for several years has been trying and succeeding in many cases in informing at least a small group of people and speaking out not just educationally, but helping people in court with unlawful detainers, the process by which landlords try to evict tenants, even in many cases where there isn't justification. In Santa Cruz and in California generally, there isn't much renter protection, and I'd love to see something like that go through City Council. When I heard a rumor that Tim Fitzmaurice, and Tim, if you're listening, love you to call in, talk about this. Councilmember Fitzmaurice was going to present some kind of elderly rent control bill for City Council, and it would be nice to see this actually happening. I know when Bob LaMonica's rent stabilization initiative was making the rounds, and that was this fall, you didn't see Chris Crone presenting it to City Council. You didn't see Mike Rotkin presenting it to City Council. You still don't see people presenting rent control to City Council. That's what we need in Santa Cruz, rent control or something like that, that will deal with this incredible speculation that is making it impossible for people of ordinary means to live here. Anyway, I went down to the Dolphin Lee because the City Council's latest proposal is the buyer's scam, as I call it, the affordable housing scam, or hoax, the Dolphin Lee hoax, in which they claim they're going to relocate is it 300 or 400 people? I'm not sure. It's certainly 68. I think it's 68 families, at least four in a family, and probably extended families up to 10. Depends on how many people are crammed into these warrens, and they are not the best rooms in town, and they are overcrowded, and they're not particularly pleasant, but they are a place to live at the moment. And the question is, will there be a place to live for the people that this city evicts with the bright, glimmering dream of affordable housing? They say, you talk to Mayor Keith Sugar, he says, oh yeah, I'm going to guarantee that everybody who gets evicted or displaced will be relocated into other housing, and then they'll be located back into this affordable housing or into equally good affordable housing. Why, then, are some of us so skeptical? Because when you look at the specifics of how this is likely to happen or how they claim this is going to happen, the city council gets very fuzzy, but the law gets very clear. And again, I'm trying to take this a step at a time. I'm taking a lot of my information from people like Phil Baer and Scott Graham and Fred Geiger, who are advocates, who are opponents of this proposal, who think that we do need affordable housing, but we've got to have affordable housing with guarantees that there'll be no evictions here. And unfortunately, what we've got is a situation where it doesn't look like that's really possible without a huge expenditure of local money by the city council, which, even though there is something of a surplus this year, I don't think there's enough to pay three or four years of rent for 400 people at the current rates in Santa Cruz. I think they're estimating it'll take 2 to 3 years to build this complex. And as I said, there are hundreds of people involved. And the theory that you're going to, first of all, pay their rents for the period of time that they're out, and then move them all back into a thing run by Mercy Housing, which has its own qualifications. For example, I'm sure they won't cram 10 people into their nice apartments, so they're not going to be able to have the same family sizes they have now. I don't think they'll take undocumented aliens. Really don't. Could be I'm wrong about that, but I really don't think that undocumented or illegal aliens will be able to go back in. I wonder if people who have credit problems are going to be able to get in, people who have arrest records. None of these questions have been discussed by City Council prior to their accepting Catherine Byers' writ, Catherine Byers' decision by fiat, Catherine Byers' decree that this is the project to which all affordable housing money for the next 5 years is going to go in. Anyway, I went down and began interviewing tenants. My Spanish is bad, and I need others. I'm going to need to do that some more with people who can help me. And I've come up with a number of questions that I continue to have. I'm not terribly persuaded that the management is the best in the world down there. I don't like the conditions that I see. But I don't understand why I still haven't gotten an answer from Tim Fitzmaurice, the city council, who spoke to me for over an hour on Sunday on the phone. I asked him this simple question. And maybe it's a little too soon to ask for it because it's only 4 days later, but seems to me that this question should have been answered months ago, and the information should be accessible to the rest of us. I said to Tim, Tim, you're going to tear down housing, existing housing, for hundreds of people with the idea of building better housing on that same site. Doesn't sound like, you know, that might be a good idea. Certainly, why not? Good idea. But around that area, there is vacant property that could be purchased probably more cheaply by the city council, by the city, and you could build housing on vacant property and just create additional housing. Why not? Why not do that? Why are you so intent on tearing this property down? And he gave me a couple of reasons. He said, well, the property around it is, much of it is Canfield-owned, and we'd have to provide extra parking spaces if we wish to destroy their parking lot, let's say, or take over eminent domain their parking lot. It would cost a lot of money for us to supply that, and it would also involve us in legal battles. And while that is happening, speculators would maybe throw out these Dolphin Lee people, take over the property, and they wouldn't have any kind of rental assistance at all. That was his reasons, as I understood it. And Tim often listens to this show, Councilmember Fitzmaurice, so if he is listening, I really encourage him to call in, because I don't want to misstate his position. I'm obviously not a partisan of his position, so I'm likely to be somewhat critical of it, and I'm not too happy with it. But that is what I understand him as telling me. He said, legal involvement, additional financial costs, and the imminent crisis and risk that the current housing and the Dolphin Lee housing that has 300 people is going to be taken over by speculators, except there are no specifics that's likely to happen. It is true that down the street rents were raised $100 at a nearby place in what seems like profiteering to me. And across the street from the Dolphin Lee, there's this thing called the Pink Palace that has kind of been abandoned. It's gone into decay and it doesn't look good. And no doubt, maybe it's sold and going to be demolished or speculated on. I don't know. But we're talking about a very particular project. This a project of folks who, and I guess I'm bringing up an old story, helped elect the city council. When the city council when the current city council majority said, we don't want Beach South of Laurel, we don't want lots of people evicted to make way for more property for the seaside company so they can develop their boardwalk on it, people from the Dolphin came down to city council and said, please don't evict us. This is the wrong thing. And they helped win the election, because when the tenants themselves said no thanks, then I think the power makers started to listen. So here they are getting threatened with eviction again. And I'm going to be talking more about this on Sunday and about what I've heard from various tenants about whether they want to leave, whether they don't want to leave. I think there's going to be some meeting in the Beach Flats on Sunday thrown by the city to kind of discuss these issues. And I encourage anyone who wants to go to call 423-HUFF to get more information, because though we know it's happening on Saturday or Sunday, they still haven't even told the tenants where and when it's happening. But there has to be real guarantees of eviction, against eviction, for real affordable housing, before this can be anything more than a gentrification project. And because those were not provided, I'm of the opinion that that's exactly what it is. And I'm still waiting for Tim Fitzmaurice to show me what persuaded him that it's a better idea to destroy existing housing than to build on vacant land nearby. I have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on the air on Free Radio.
Hi, Tim Fitzmaurice here.
You don't sound like Tim Fitzmaurice.
I can't get a thing by you, can I?
This sounds like that slumlord who is often shilled for by Robert Norris, Phil Bear.
Charles Canfield.
Oh, Charles Canfield. Hi, Charles.
No, Scott Kennedy.
You can't fool me, Phil Bear.
You are too shrewd for words, Robert.
Well, you're a slumlord in the Beach Flats.
Thank you very much.
What's it all about? Tell me.
A slumlord in the Beach Flats?
Yes. I mean...
It's just titillating.
Really? You actually are a landlord in the Beach Flats, and you're a resident who's lived here for, what, 20 years?
Yes, sir.
And you've got a concern about Dolphin Lee, which we, of course, have talked about on this show. Anything you want to say regarding... I guess I came to your house today with 3 pages of information about complaints from tenants in the Dolphin Lee about repairs and problems with the property. But when I talked to Linda Garner, who is the... What is she, the building inspector person for the city?
Yes, the building inspector for the target area, which is essentially the Beach Flats.
Right.
So this one woman for the last, I think, 7 years has been full-time in charge of housing essentially in the Beach Flats area. She's been in every unit of housing in the Beach Flats area, most of them several times, knows the area up and down.
Well, I actually called her because I wanted to find out. I'm trying to find out, because, frankly, I'm not terribly impressed with the interior of the Beach Flats housing. It's, you know...
Well, you're a rich kind of guy. You have high standards.
It's true, I do. Let me put it this way. I'm a pretty grubby character, and I live in pretty garrety places myself. But I don't try to live there with 2 little kids and 3 other people. It's kind of hard. I mean, I I'm not used to. I don't hail from El Salvador or Mexico, where, you know, come to the United States and you gotta kind of shift for yourself as best you can in housing. But I did interview 2 folks, which I'm not gonna be able to play tonight, but I will be playing, I guess, on Sunday for all you folks who want to tune in from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon. And I got this list of complaints about the housing, which I showed you, Phil,
mm-hmm.
I guess from about, it looks like 10 or 12 tenants,
mm-hmm.
and I presume more. This was compiled...
I thought it was 11.
Was it 11? And they said there was this exemplative rather than exhaustive. And this was, I think, assisted by the Western Service Workers, a group concerned with tenants' rights. And I guess you're on pretty good terms with them, right, Phil?
Yes.
And I think you probably have some sympathy with tenants complaining about bad conditions.
I suppose.
Even if they might not be technically substandard in terms of red tagging or anything of that sort, if folks have concerns, I think you would be concerned about that. At least I would.
Right, though I would suggest that they do it in a way that's likely to actually get the problems remedied. There is a prescribed way of doing that. I suspect you've done it yourself, where you inform the property owner of the problem. The property owner, depending on the nature of the problem, has either 30 or 60 days to fix the problem, after which time you are legally able to take care of the problem yourself and take the cost of taking care of the problem out of the next month's rent, providing the property owner with receipts for any money that you've had to spend. That will hold up in any court in the country, and that actually gets the problem addressed. This letter seems like more of a political gesture for some reason.
Well, I mean, I'm concerned about that too, but let me kind of fence you in a little on this one. People who are here from another country who do not speak English very well might not know about these rights.
Well, then Western Service workers, or you, or I, or anyone who cared enough to do so, ought to be telling them exactly what their legal rights are,
right,
and perhaps
and
helping them to do this.
But imagine the situation of an individual, for example, who does not have legal documentation. He or she would have no real legal recourse, even if they were, you know, correct and in their concern. That's point one.
I'm not sure that that's the case. If they are on a lease and they follow that procedure for getting whatever the problem with their housing fixed, and they take it out of the rent, and the property owner objects to that and goes to court or attempts to evict them, any of that is illegal. And like you say, those folks have to know that it's illegal,
well,
and they
have to
be ready to resist it,
right,
but that's the way it's done.
Yeah, but you not only have to know, you have to have, a lawyer to come in with you to help resist it, a lawyer.
No, that's
well,
not true.
You have to be able to, you have to be able to speak English, or you have to be able to...
I don't think that's true.
...to get together a translator. I mean, let me put it this way. I don't know how many people who are mainly Spanish speakers who have effectively used the English language courts in Santa Cruz. Now, I don't know. Maybe they do. But I'm saying that it's probably a bigger burden than you or I to use the courts.
For certain.
Right.
It is a problem. I'm not denying it,
right,
that it's a problem. And it's pretty obvious that they need some sort of assistance from somebody who knows the law and is bilingual. And that is an obstacle. There's no doubt about it. I'm just indicating the way that actually addresses the problem, as opposed to lends itself to somebody else's political agenda, and it probably does nothing more than irritate the property owner and never gets the problem solved.
Well, let me clarify what you're saying, because you, I know what you're talking about, but I think what you're saying is that this series of complaints that I showed you today about the Dolphin Lee, which was sort of dated January 31st and talked about real problems in the Dolphin Lee, may have been organized by folks with a political interest in claiming that the Dolphin Lee is substandard housing, slumlord housing, that needs to be torn down and seized by the city so that an affordable housing project, to wit the Dolphin Lee project, can be built there. That you're suggesting that maybe this series of complaints stems from a political agenda that is not...
Yes.
Doesn't originate with the tenants. Right?
Not quite so directly as you're putting it. Like, I would not impugn the motives of Western Service workers who I think just are philosophically on the tenant side and would respond to, or even to some degree orchestrate, a tenant's effort to do something like this, but I don't think that they are aware that what is really underneath it all, or the function that this will serve, will be to fuel those people who are calling for the destruction of that building, when, of course, none of the complaints that were cited in that three-page letter were anything more than having to do with broken appliances and clogged drains and peeling linoleum, nothing that even comes close to justifying demolition. But the letter itself will be used that way, and I'm sure that either the developer or a proponent on the city council or someone there is motivating this whole thing to happen, and both the tenants and Western service workers are being used in that regard.
Well, I've been, you know, a person listening to you who doesn't know you and knows of you as a person who is a landlord himself who lives there might say, oh, here's this landlord making these claims. But looking at the fact that the city council has allowed very little public process on this whole question, and I had a long argument with Tim Fitzmaurice about this on Sunday. He has a different perspective. He feels that the meetings were public process. I don't think they were.
Well, if they were, it seemed pretty obvious to me that the public expressed absolutely no interest in the project. If those meetings are what we're calling public process, then what Tim should have gotten from the public is absolutely nothing by way of a public endorsement of the project. Nobody spoke up for it, and a number of people expressed a certain cynical disbelief, you know. If there was a public process, the public said, no, thank you.
Well, of course, he was referring to three meetings that happened, one in May, I think, one later, September or October, out of the community trailer down there in the Beach Flats, where they first in May announced there was no Dolphin Lee project, and then suddenly there was a Dolphin Lee project, and then Catherine Byers suddenly said, this is our project, and we're all going to vote for it, and there it goes.
Whist, absolutely.
Zippity-doo-dah.
And an absolutely hurried, non-formalized public process where they got a response that was clearly not the response they were seeking, so they just chose to forego the rest of the public process and act like it had already been done when it has not been done.
Well, I talked to two of those tenants today in actually two adjacent units. One of them happened to be washing her clothes in the laundromat, and the other was next door. One of them was happy with the idea, by the way, of demolishing the building, and was happy with the vision of some new housing. The other one was less certain as to what the situation was, though, of course, anybody who's offered spacious new housing, I would say,